Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition. Have all the things be better. This episode is sponsored by OmniFocus 3.
So, Manton, bad week for Twitter equals good week for micro.blog.
Pretty much. Every time there's some bad Twitter news, we get a nice little spike in users joining micro.blog. So I don't exactly wish for bad news for Twitter, but there's always something going on where people kind of open their eyes and they're like, you know what? What else is out there? Is there something else that I can use?
You're like, why are my enrollment rates going up so fast? Twitter just annoyed half of the world.
Right. No, not half the world. Just 1% not half the world. Of their
1%
user base.
Is enough. You'll take 1% and you'll be happy.
Absolutely. Didn't Steve Jobs famously say they only wanted 1% of the cell phone market or something? Now look at them.
Yeah, it's reminding me for some reason with the half the world thing. It's reminding me of the Will Shipley C4 talk where he's like, give your app away to half the world and they'll tell the other half to buy it. Love that.
That's not a bad strategy.
Not a bad idea.
You got to then support half the world for free. So I don't know. Maybe that doesn't scale.
You got to think it through at least.
So more bad Twitter news. I mean, they are following through on a change that they really announced like a year ago and became a bigger deal about a month ago. And I think we probably touched on this on the podcast about a month ago. I can't really remember, but like the Apps of a Feather website, which is a few different Twitter apps kind of coming together to educate users on like, hey, one of our APIs is going away, like how we handle push notifications, how we handle live updates in the app, how we handle direct messages. These things are changing. Like, please be aware and don't blame us, blame Twitter. And there was a big outcry a month ago, and Twitter said, oh, we're so surprised. We can't believe people are not happy, and so we'll postpone. And a lot of people thought that postpone comment was kind of like, and I even heard from people even just like a week ago, like, oh, didn't Twitter say they were postponing this indefinitely and then nothing's going to change? No, that's not what they said. They just said they're going to take some time to think about it. Yeah. And they took some time to think about it. And a month later, they said, yeah, we're back on schedule. We've delayed by 3 months, but we're not changing anything. Like, this is the plan. This is what we're doing.
I'm so confused by it because it's one of these situations where over the years, Twitter has done these things that come across as particularly... It's kind of funny, Manton. This is it used to be kind of weird when we were being sponsored by Twitter because they were legitimately doing good things for developers through their like Crashlytics and Fabric wing. At the same time as they were like shutting down services for actual Twitter API developers. But now, it's like it seems like over the years they have kind of simultaneously followed through. Like you said, you recently wrote a blog post about like following through on the 2012 Twitter promise, basically, that they would, basically that they're not in the business of providing services to developers that allow for third-party Twitter full-fledged clients.
Traditional full-featured clients.
And so like for the past 6 years or more, they've been expressing this through their actions. And then inevitably, somebody at Twitter seems to say, "Oh no, we didn't mean that directed at third party clients." And I'm kind of skimming through my Twitter as it happens here to try to find like one of these reactions recently. I guess I'm not 100% caught up on this because the last I saw was a response on Twitter that was like, "No, we don't mean that for third parties." So was there some like I know that there was the big like. Yeah, like you said, a few weeks ago, there was the big like, okay, we're canceling this API. And then they're like, oh, we're postponing it. And then there was like, haha, we're actually canceling it. And then something else happened. Do you know about that something else? Or am I just like imagining that?
There's not really something else. They postponed things and now it's back on with a delay. So the original date that some of these APIs were going to be deprecated / shut off. It's not when Twitter says deprecated, it's not quite clear if it's actually going to be turned off immediately or it's just like completely unsupported. Most people interpret some of those dates as like, no, it's actually going away on that date. So June, in the middle of June, was like the original date, and now it's been pushed back to August. something like that.
Right.
And but essentially nothing's changed. They did make one change based on feedback last week to the I think to the part of the direct message API for polling previous direct messages. They had changed the rate limits as part of one of these changes, which made it like extremely slow to go and fill in direct messages in your history. And now they've kind of brought those rate limits more in line with other APIs, so Twitter clients can hit them more often. That's a good change, but it doesn't really significantly change the fact that a couple major APIs are going away. And they're being replaced by essentially a new API that is much more full-featured, better in many ways, but it's just not for the Twitterifics and Tweetbots of the world. It's for enterprise customers. It's for people that don't mind spending $3,000 a month for a very small number of users, for their like support staff or for monitoring, you know, search terms for their brands or, you know, whatever. It's just unrelated to what most of us want in a Twitter app, right?
Yeah, right.
And a lot of people took that pricing and they're like, this is crazy. They've got to lower the price. They're not going to lower the price. This is for enterprise customers. This is so they can make $1 million off a lot of enterprise customers versus like $1,000 off, you know, Twitterific. They're not going to change the strategy. I'd be shocked if they change it.
Well, I guess it's one of those things. Back to how we started this. It's I mean, on the one hand, if Twitter made an about face, and we've talked about this before, if Twitter made an about face and became like a fully open web embracing company, and adopted all of the recommendations and guidelines of your microblogging philosophy, it would be kind of weird because it would be like a huge philosophical, it would be a huge success for the mission of micro.blog and your personal microblogging ambitions, but it would in a way be not good for micro.blog's business. Or do you think that's not true?
I think it would be fine for the business.
Yeah.
But you're right. It would be in a lot of ways be like, well, mission accomplished. Like Twitter's open now. And you know, it's not that's not gonna happen. But if it did happen, I think it might still be okay for micro.blog because one of the things that people miss about micro.blog, and this is confusing because we've talked about how micro.blog is two things, like it's a social network and a blog platform, and that's confusing to people, and you kind of need to wrap your head around that, and it's confusing from like kind of a marketing and branding perspective, but there's a really important reason that it's two things, and that is the business is blog hosting. And so even if Twitter has open APIs and they change their kind of like complete perspective on how they should treat third-party developers, I don't think it really changes the business of micro.blog, which is blog hosting. And I think in a lot of ways that business like protects us in a way from some competition because the hosting space for blogs is already full of competition, right? Nothing is changing in that way. It kind of like, it's a really important, I think it's like an under maybe appreciated part of how micro.blog works is that the business is separate from like the timeline experience. And that's actually, that's really powerful because it means we can encourage third-party apps. It doesn't matter if they compete with us. It means we don't have to worry about ads and other kind of business problems. So I think if Twitter, they're not going to change what they're doing, but if they did, I think it would still be okay. We'd probably, maybe we'd adjust micro.blog a little bit to work better with Twitter, but probably just continue to do what we think is the right thing for the platform.
You and your consistent philosophical standards. You know, talking about APIs, I want to make a quick mention here while I'm thinking about it. We talked last week about Ghost and the Ghost API and how I had had that little interaction where I felt like they were sort of dismissive of me asking for an API because, you know, they were like, hey, if you want an API, then make it yourself. I was like, no, thanks. So I guess, I don't know, this is a little bit of a non sequitur, but it's related to last week. And you just reminded me talking about, you know, these APIs and Twitter. And here's an example where you would think with like a completely open source blogging platform, and especially one that has a history of saying, hey, if you want it, just make it, that some of the same challenges wouldn't apply. But we got an interesting note from Samuel Goodwin, friend of mine and listener of the show on Twitter. It just so happens, I guess he uses Ghost. I'm not 100% sure, but he says, he messaged us on Twitter at Corient. He says, I've talked to the Ghost people about their API, and they explained they were waiting on some security expert or something who was busy. Definitely not a priority.
Huh.
And then he says, I did volunteer to build the API, even. So here's somebody who has approached Ghost about volunteering to develop the API for their platform. This might be a mischaracterization. I don't know. It's just coming, you know, this is through one person on behalf of another entity, but he seems to have the impression that that's something's blocked in Ghost sort of planning zone. His final tweet to us was, quote, it's just pinned to one person who hasn't touched it for about 4 years now. I don't know. I just want to follow up on that, because even when you have an open platform, you know, if there's still, it's kind of interesting that even if there's like an attitude of like, hey, if you want it, come build it. This, if we take it on the face of it, is somebody who said, hey, I'm here, I want it, I'm going to build it for you. And they're like, no, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's still that second kind of question about like, what are you building? Are you building like a new custom API, or are you adopting like existing standards? Yeah. I'm not, if it's been 4 years.
Right. Well,
doesn't seem like a priority.
The thing is, I totally empathize with Ghost's attitude if it's, no, we don't want somebody just coming along and developing an API that's going to represent us to the world without our involvement. Now, the irony is, I think that's basically what they asked me to do when I suggested this, whatever, 4 years ago. You know, so on the one hand, I can totally see why, yes, if I were running an open source project or a foundation and I had a brand associated with that, no, I wouldn't want to just willy-nilly outsource something as important as an API to whoever steps up. But there's a little bit of a mixed message here, because, I mean, you know, and to be fair, maybe their attitude has changed over the years since I spoke with them. But it sounds like we're in that unfortunate situation now, or at least Ghost users are in that unfortunate situation where the platform directors, the people who are in charge, don't want to build the API themselves and don't want somebody else to build it without their their guidance.
And it might be one of those things where, like, they had kind of a philosophy 4 years ago, 5 years ago about the API. And then every once in a while, someone jumps in like, hey, what about an API? And maybe one of the new employees even at Ghost is like, oh yeah, what about that? And they check into it, and then it's kind of like the first reaction is, oh yeah, we really should do that. And then they're like, well, now we kind of see why it hasn't been done yet, and there was reasons, and now it gets stalled and nothing really happens. And it's actually similar parallel with, like, just kind of wrapping up back with the Twitter stuff. You know, you mentioned it's been 6 years. I wrote this blog post about they're finally kind of executing on the plans, you know, 6 years ago. And a lot of people, you know, I heard some feedback. Most of the feedback I heard on that post was really good. And people were like nodding, oh yeah, I can see this is happening. We had the warnings, you know, years ago. But some people were like, no, Twitter just doesn't know what they're doing. They're just like stumbling through. And I didn't name the people I quoted in that blog post because they don't even work at Twitter anymore, right? They're moved on to completely different companies. So you can make the argument, they don't know what they're doing, they're just kind of stumbling through. But I think what happens is actually very similar to the Ghost problem, where there's some new person in charge of Twitter developer relations or in charge of the API, and they hear the outcry from us, you know, sites like Apps of a Feather, and just like the pushback against the API, and they're like, oh, this is bad. Like, yeah, we want to support third-party clients. But then they kind of look into it, and then they realize that, no, that's really not the business and the direction that Twitter has been on for years. And it's not as simple as just saying, we want to support third-party developers. And so when I talk about this was set in motion 6 years ago, you can't just like hire a new person and like unset that in motion. It's kind of almost ingrained in the way Twitter works.
Well, just to like kind of pick an obvious example that is probably a similar conundrum that many employees face. It's like, imagine if there existed such a thing as like a web-based business who thrived on advertisements that, you know, were better the more you know about your customer. you know, you could work at one of those companies and be like, hey, I believe in privacy. I believe in, you know, having control over your own content. And then somebody says, hey, did you notice that like your company is totally like reading all my emails and giving me like, you know,
yeah,
catered ads to the specific things I talk to my friends about? And you could imagine like off the cuff, somebody with a good, you know, conscience being like, yeah, that's horrible. I'm going to totally fix that. I'm going to get right back to work.
Right.
And then same thing. You're like, oh, that's actually why I get paid so much.
Right. it's totally true. I mean, you can't separate these things sometimes. Like if your business depends on certain foundations, you can't change them without changing the direction of your company. And so that's why it's so important. And I think we lose track. I mean, we don't lose track of it quite as much as we used to, you know. I mean, people repeat the, you know,
if you're not the customer, then you're the product.
You're the product. Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah. Like, I remember. But people know that and like repeat it now. So it's not like we're completely oblivious, but we still go through day-to-day tasks using all these services that are quote unquote free and have all these gotchas. And we just kind of accept that that's kind of the way things are. And unraveling that is extremely difficult. So if you start a new business, you have to think about what you're trying to do, like what what your vision is, and get it right from the beginning, because it's difficult to change. All right, we're happy to have Omni Group sponsoring the podcast again to talk about OmniFocus 3. OmniFocus 3 for iOS is coming soon. It will ship on May 30th, that's next week, and it's a fresh major update to this well-loved app from the Omni Group. New features include flexible inspectors so that OmniFocus works the way you want it to work. The forecast view now interleaves tasks and events so you can plan your days better. And most importantly, we've replaced contexts with tags. You can apply multiple tags to your tasks and projects, where before you could apply just one context. This opens up a powerful new world of custom perspectives and workflows. Think of combining tags for energy level, priority, location, person, and so on. Read all about this and more at Inside OmniFocus. That's inside.omnifocus.com. And there's a new podcast episode linked there from the Omni Show all about the new release. Thanks to the Omni Group for sponsoring the show.
Manton, it's very rare that there are apps I can talk about that I can say with true belief that they have changed my life. And I think if you ask my wife, she would agree. If you ask like people who depend on me for things at my kids' school, the PTO, if they knew how irresponsible, forgetful, not following through I was before I started using OmniFocus. It's a revelation to me. It's been a few years now. It's really made me accountable to my own ambitions. And it doesn't mean I get everything done when I think I'm going to get it done. I think that's magical thinking. But what it means is everything that I plan to do, I make a note of it. It goes to OmniFocus and I think about it again. I either do it or I think about doing it. I schedule it, whatever. It doesn't get lost. So I want to make a special appeal here to folks who don't have a system like that. Because if you're like me, you used to have this problem where it's like, I'm going to try to do that sometime. And this can be anything from like, I'm going to try to remember next time I'm in San Francisco to call my friend who lives there and make a lunch date. Or I'm going to try to remember to put the trash out on Sundays like I'm supposed to. All these little things, OmniFocus can handle them all. And don't get too caught up in all the details. The beautiful thing about a system like with OmniFocus, just start throwing stuff into it. Give it due dates, give it review dates, do whatever you want, but you'll have it in there. You'll have a list of things that you want to be accountable to yourself for. And that's the greatest gift that OmniFocus has given me. I'm so excited about the new version coming, as Manton said. It's coming next week. You can learn more at inside.omnifocus.com. And also, of course, be sure to check out that Omni Show podcast, great show with Brent Simmons and folks, various folks from the Omni Group. Thanks to the Omni Group and OmniFocus 3 for sponsoring the show. Well, Manton, Mars Edit 4.1 is something that I believe will ship at some point in the future. And
that's good. That's a start.
That's a familiar attitude. It's funny that, you know, I spent so long finally getting Mars Edit 4 out the door. And back in December, if you would have asked me, I would have estimated that, you know, Mars Edit 4 shipped on December 5th. I would have estimated that I get like Mars edit 401, 402, 403 out the door. Maybe 4.1 would ship like end of January. Now it's almost end of May. What can I say? Things take a long time sometimes. And we talked a little bit before about me going down this whole like RS image road with trying to handle images better. And like this all just started with like a simple request, like, hey, I would like it if my metadata were preserved when I uploaded. And that turned into this big, you know, oh, but which metadata do I preserve? And So I made some good progress on that front. Actually, I have a nice, you know, I have a nice new setup now where in the forthcoming 4.1, there's going to be a pop-up menu that lets you choose like strip all the metadata, strip everything but the location, or preserve all the metadata. Yay, that's done. So moving on to the next item on my list. This has been in my Fogbugs now manuscript database for years. And it's the simplest thing. The only saving grace of this bug is it's so widespread that users understand that it's not just Mars Edit. They don't understand why. Nobody understands why such a simple thing doesn't work. And that simple thing is dragging an image from Photos app to any other app on your Mac.
Right. You'd think that would just work. And until I saw this in our notes to talk about, I just assume I don't use Photos app, so yeah. I just assumed that it was fine. Turns out, it's not fine. It hardly works anywhere.
It hardly works anywhere, and Mars Edit 4.1 will be one of the rare differentiated cases where it does work. And this is one of those like be in my bonnet type issues where I to be honest, I don't get a lot of feedback about this because I think partly because Mars Edit has a media browser built into it, so you don't have to go like drag images in from another app. But you know how people are. They have their workflows. Some people just want to work in the other app and then drag it in. And who am I to say they shouldn't be able to do something that's like a fundamental differentiating behavior of the Mac? Well, it turns out the reason it's so hard to get drag and drop working from Photos app is because Apple invented a new form of drag and drop for Photos. And any app that hasn't in some way updated to accommodate that is not able to understand the format. In a nutshell, it's a format that promises the presence of a file at a specific URL in the future. So there's a lot of complications here. Any developers listening are already going, oh, I get it now. That's rough because it takes what used to be a synchronous thing like, hey, here's a file with an image in it, or here's some image data on the pasteboard, and it turns it into something where now, in order to support drags from Photos, an app has to be aware of this specific type of, it's called a drag promise. And drag promises have existed on the Mac in the past, but in the past they were based on paths. And the new drag promise is based on URLs. And it shouldn't be that much different, but the way it works now is just like just enough work to support it that you can imagine it being not the top of every developer's list. Right. So it was a real drag when Apple came out with this, and suddenly it works with almost nothing. Almost, I mean, it's fair to say almost nothing can accept a drag from Photos. Yep. Notable exceptions are like you can drag to preview app, you can drag to mail. You know, they covered their bases on like the real fundamental integration points for the Mac.
You can drag to the Finder, but you get a little bit of what I consider strange behavior, which is it creates, for like 1 second, it creates like a really weird file name that's long and not correct. And then it, when the drag finishes, you know, when it, the promise is fulfilled, probably, it goes back and renames it to the whatever.jpg. So it's a little bit clunky even in the Finder. Yeah, this doesn't work in the micro.blog app. I support dragging photos in to attach them to a post. does not work. I had no idea actually until today.
Right. So you're a great example of the many, many, many developers who expect that, for example, if there's like a pasteboard type called, well, I mean, here's the funny thing. If you ask, like, there's an NSImage method on the Mac called like dragging image types or something. Mm-hmm. And one of the like old school ways to handle drags of images into your app is to simply register for all the types that NSImage says are image dragging types. That doesn't get you Photos app. And
it doesn't work with the, like, I accept just regular file drags as well.
Yeah.
And it does not work. That's the part that is particularly surprising to me. I would expect that would work because why not? Why not? I mean, that, I don't know. It's such a common thing to drag a file.
Yep.
And I could understand for efficiency, like, let's say you select 1,000 photos in the Photos app and you drag them, and maybe mm-hmm. it's not optimal to have actual file references for all those 1,000 when you drag it to another app. But it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of a frustrating behavior.
I agree completely. And in fact, my gut reaction is the same, I think, as everybody's, which is Apple should have done something to make this work better out of the box. And it's a tricky one because when you start to look at it and you start to understand what Apple's design priorities were, it starts to become more understandable why it works the way it does. Never once does it become okay that the behavior is the way it is for so many apps by default, in my opinion.
Right.
But here are some reasons that I have come to understand why it works the way it does. The first and the most obvious is actually photos.app on the Mac doesn't have a file for every photo that it shows you in the app.
Might be in the cloud.
So
or
it might be in the cloud is the short, yeah, the synopsis of it. So in order to drag like a bona fide representation of that photo, not just like a little preview image of it to another app, because of course, if you're dragging this thing over to like, you know, Photoshop or something, whatever, I don't even know if it works to drag to Photoshop, to be honest. But if you're dragging it to some other app where you expect to do real work on it, you don't want some little preview version of it. You want the real thing. So that's sort of like one of the explanations. What doesn't make as much sense is like, why can't they? Because a lot of images for a lot of people's photo libraries are backed by files. Like they have a local copy. Like if I have iCloud photo syncing turned off, for example, you would think maybe you would just drag, like you're saying, drag like file paths. And it doesn't. It just consistently works with this asynchronous promise URL approach. And I think, you know, you can kind of empathize with the Photos folks. It's like they want to have like a consistent behavior for how you get drags from the app. Unfortunately, that means, you know, like there's a lot of cases that could just work instantly and immediately, but don't. And I guess it's better in a way that it just always fails than if it's just unpredictable to the user whether it's going to succeed or fail.
Yeah, I can definitely see that argument because the user will be confused if like half their photos are stored locally and half in the cloud and some don't work and they just can't tell because it's kind of transparent. So I have a question, like technically, does this only work with the Dragon? Does it work kind of on top of NSURL or is it work just as part of the drag API? Because where I'm getting at with the question is when you mentioned Photoshop, I was thinking, well, for an image editor, often you drag onto the icon of the app to open.
Right.
I'm going to guess that that doesn't work with this. Is that right?
It's a good question.
Because when you drag to, you know, a file or multiple files to an app, obviously the app is launched if it's not there and it gets called with, you know, open URLs or whatever it is. Unless this is purely based on NSURL, I don't see how the promises would work in that case.
I think you're right. I happen to have photos open and I happen to know that drags to, well, this is an interesting question because I thought that drags to preview worked. You know, I just don't know. I guess there might be a way for, I don't know enough about that, but it doesn't work purely with NSURLs. The way it works is you have to interact with the drag system in a way that you actually provide it with a URL that you want to be fulfilled with the content of the drag.
Right.
So like when Photos comes to Mars Edit, it says, hey, I've got some URL stuff for you. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. What do you think? And then you say, yes, please make it work here. And I give them a URL to a temporary folder. And then they call me back when it's done. Yeah. Now, this is new as of 10.12, I should just say. So hats off to the folks who implemented support for drags from Photos. Like, I spoke quite a bit with one of the developers from Panic who worked on this for Transmit. And they did it like before this 10.12 API. The 10.12 API basically like made it slightly, I should be honest, it made it a lot less painful. But in the before 10.12, you had to like pull the file system, I think, to see when the drag actually ended up arriving.
Right, yeah. It's a lot of extra work.
But so like the other big angle to this, so the one angle is you don't just get images. I mentioned the asynchronous thing. The asynchronous thing is huge because the vast majority, I would say, of apps on the Mac, and this is something to the limited knowledge I have about iOS drag and drop, I think this is going to be different for folks coming from iOS because I think iOS is asynchronous universally, like across the board. And on the Mac, it's kind of new. I mean, we've had some asynchronicity in drag and drop in the past, but if you're just expecting to get an image, you didn't really ever really expect that to be an asynchronous thing.
Well, if I remember correctly, the way Promises used to work, it was the opposite of what you described. Like, it was the app that you were dragging from. It was their responsibility to fulfill the promise, right? So, like, if I drag from Photos, not Photos, but like a hypothetical Photos app, to your app, and it's a promise, when the app is when the drag is successful, quote unquote, I need to fulfill that really quick before you get the image data. Do you know what I'm saying? I thought that's the way it worked. And if it worked that way, it would work with all apps. But the downside is like there would be a lag between the drop and when your app was notified.
Yeah, so it might be part of the sandboxing approach that requires that the host app give a URL that it knows it has access to. I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly.
The more we talk about this, the more frustrated I am because this sounds like this will never work in certain cases. Like the example I just said is like dragging a photo from Photos app onto like, let's say the Acorn icon to open that photo in Acorn. It sounds like that will never work without a new API. And that seems confusing to me. That's like behavior we kind of expected to work from like shoebox style apps and apps that they are obviously managing files, but they're doing it in a kind of a special way. We kind of expect that those can be dragged around as if they're files. And this changes that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is it will work if Acorn implements the dragging support.
But it won't. Because this, I'm talking about dragging it onto the app icon.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yep. I'm not sure about that. And so far in my little limited tests here, dragging to app icons doesn't seem to work. So you're right. It's a change. Now a workaround, and this is a workaround that anybody should keep in mind if they're just using Photos with anything, is like you were saying, drag it to the desktop first.
Yeah.
And then drag it to anything you want to.
Yeah.
And then it works as you would expect. And so as far as workarounds go, that's a pretty straightforward one, but it's not a very Mac-like thing to have to do. So there's one other interesting thing I want to mention because like the whole question came up a little bit. I was talking with this. Some people responded on Twitter about this problem. One of the interesting responses was from Brian Webster, who has done a lot of work with images because, you know, one of his apps is, I forget what it's called on the Photos version, but he used to make an iPhoto sync something app. I should look it up here.
They like manage multiple photo libraries and sync stuff around. Yeah.
Right. So he was like the master of like managing. Oh yeah. It's called iPhoto Library Manager.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out he's still selling both. He's got iPhoto Library Manager, This is at Fat Cat.
Version
right.
iPhoto, yeah.
This is at fatcatsoftware.com, and he's got power photos for doing the same kind of thing, but with photos. And so he knows a lot about photos and iPhoto and how all this stuff works. And he responded to a thread, because it was like, I posted about, I was kind of celebrating the fact that Mars Edit would do this. And then Renee Ritchie from iMore responded, kind of like along the lines of what you're saying, Matt. And he said that just doesn't work natively since Photos launch remains a constant source of frustration. And this is, a power user, power journalist for the Mac is totally confused and frustrated by this. I'm right there with him. Whatever went into this decision-making process, it has undeniably led to poor user experience. But I thought Brian's response was interesting. He says, for what it's worth, I think some of the primary motivation behind Photos drag and drop behavior is to not expose the underlying file paths inside the library to avoid breaking iCloud photo library syncing. And he goes on to say, basically, theoretically, when you drag a photo to another app, it has like implicit right to use that photo and modify it. And it's kind of like what you're describing. Like you drag it to an app icon. It's like opening up a file.
Mm-hmm.
And so like if you get one of these files, you could theoretically like apply a filter to it and save it. And then now it's different. And what he's saying is basically like a design goal of iCloud photo or of photos might have been that they don't want any third-party app to have access to the originals.
Which I completely, yeah. So I would actually expect that. I would, as a user, if I dragged a file out,
yep,
I would actually expect to get some kind of copy, I think.
Right.
Maybe. It's complicated. Yeah. It's a little bit.
And, that being said, though, making a copy, especially now with APFS, is extremely cheap. It does seem like there could have been some compromises here. But it's kind of one of these things where it's like, anyway, I guess getting back to my thrust of my comment about this, it's one of these weird things where like a little bee in my bonnet, as I said, led into this way bigger undertaking than I expected. And I'm not even done yet, to be honest. I have it working, but there's this to-do item I still feel like I have to add, which is some kind of like visual UI for the progress of when you're waiting for the drag to complete.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the time, it's like almost instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you saw dragging to the Finder, it was like, hey, I'm getting something, and then now I have it.
It takes about a second or so, yeah.
Right,
and
but
on the Mac, we're probably mostly on Wi-Fi.
Exactly, but like, yeah, imagine you're on like a 56K dial-up connection, and your photos are on iCloud and I don't know where, Cupertino or something. And then, not in Cupertino really, but maybe they're on the other side of the world from where you are. And you say, hey, I'd like to drag this image to Mars Edit. And then it's like, okay, I'll get right on that, downloading this like 4 megabyte image over 56K. It's just like, it's one of these things that has complications upon complications. And in the end, it ended up being like, I had to redo my whole drag system to change it from, I know how to look at a pasteboard and get things off of it, to I allowed photos to win. I changed my whole drag and drop handling system for Mars Edit to an asynchronous thing, where instead of saying now, because I have this code in Mars Edit that says, hey, I've got a pasteboard, can you get an image off of this? And it says, sure, here's an image. And it gives me like a local path to a cached copy of it. Now I've had to change that to say, hey, I've got a pasteboard, get back to me if you can get an image. And this is just for the same reason I think that they decided to be consistent, I'm consistent with it. And it's like now getting an image off the pasteboard is an asynchronous thing. And it feels good to have this work done, but wow, it was a lot more fiddling than I expected. And like I said, I'm still not done.
Yeah. I mean, it's your app's better because of the work, and like users they won't appreciate it because they won't know that it wasn't supposed to work. So they'll just be happy, which is good. And the rest of us that are lagging behind might get the occasional, I haven't heard any feedback about this, but like I would not be surprised if someone says, oh, by the way, I can't drag photos into your app. And
oh, and from now on, once 4.1 ships, they're going to be like, why doesn't this work? It works in Mars Edit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. This is, I think, extremely low on my priority list, but it sounds like something that, you know, most developers should probably take a look at, unless Apple, you know, in 2 weeks at WWDC is going to change how Photos works drastically, which doesn't seem likely. So good. I've learned something today. Thank you for the developer history lesson, or the API lesson.
Yeah. And you know, folks, if you're a developer, I'm not going to make a specific promise about this, but I do have it on my list to blog about this from a developer point of view. So if you've already been waiting for months and months to do this, if you think it might be easier, maybe just wait a few weeks. And I think I'll blog after I publish the Mars Edit update to sort of explain how to approach this.
That's good.
It's a little easier in some ways than I thought it was going to be, especially with the 10.12 and later API. But there are still these considerations that are like, ooh, that was not obvious.
So Daniel, as we wrap up the show, I wanted to kind of quickly talk about the Developers Union. This is a site that launched just, I guess, a week ago or so, thedeveloperunion.org. And it's right now it's not like a full like union like you would expect from factory workers or any industry that's like really long and established that needs to represent workers. But it's similar kind of in spirit, and then it's like, developers, let's get together right now, sign your name, you know, on the website, and let's try as a group to make it more clear to Apple what we think the priority should be with the App Store. And so I put my name on this. I like the general idea of the like developers focusing on something, because like we can complain about the App Store and Apple policies for 10 years, and we have off and on, but if they don't hear like a coherent message, it's easy for them to either think it's not a priority or to ignore it, or I don't know. I like the idea of like the kind of focus that this could bring of like, this is an issue, or these are a couple issues the developers care about. Apple, we'd like you to like reply to this or like do something.
Yeah. Yeah. I also signed up very enthusiastically and without hesitation. I mean, just without hesitation, because this is actually something that I've thought we need something like for many, many years. And it appeals to me probably more than it appeals to some, because personally, I like the idea of something more akin to an actual union.
Right.
Because I'm kind of like, you know, I believe in like collective workers' rights, and we're far from an oppressed like workers group, as you know, high level, you know, iOS and Mac developers. But I don't shy away from the idea of believing that, you know, you also have like, it shouldn't only be like lower paid or more oppressed workers groups that can gain power by being consolidated, you know? And on the other hand, like, I'm like, yes, sign me up. Here's my, you know, and they have in the fact, they have like, when their very first fact is this a union with dues and stuff? And they say, no, this is a non-union union. And I'm like, okay, well, that explains that. So it's really, I think I'm very supportive of the thrust of this movement. And I think if I take off my like, I'm like generally for unions and workers' rights and all this stuff, I think it's possible that this would be better served with a name that doesn't have union in it. Because if I step back a minute, I realize like there's a lot of like, it's kind of like calling it, it would kind of be like if you called it like liberal developers group or something, you know, like even a lot of people who agree with like liberal politics don't want to be called a liberal, and people who are self-identify as conservative certainly don't want to be called a liberal. And so like, I think there's more, you know, union should be a sort of like more neutral term than it is. But the fact is, I think that this will turn some people off because it's called a union. And that's too bad. The other thing, like, I don't know why I'm just jumping into my criticisms here, because I am generally supportive. But the other thing that occurred to me is just that, like, This is a tricky thing to try to try to get a handle on the huge variety of grievances that Apple's developers have, and to try to pick one or two things that, you know, to fight for on behalf of everybody. And although I am really passionate about wanting free trials in the app stores, so this was a perfect pitch to me. Like, I still think it's a great idea. You know, flip responses from a lot of people I've seen in Slacks and on Twitter is, hey, you can already do free trials. And they refer and allude to stuff like what the Omni Group is doing, what I'm doing with in-app purchases. But those of us who have done that know better than anybody that those are not the same as real free trials. Like, right. We know all the problems that come with that. But just to say, I think that, so I'm looking at the page right now, 547 people have signed up so far, or 474 people and 547 apps. I don't think that all of those people are specifically concerned about free trials. And I wonder if, you know, maybe this is early days. I wonder if maybe like the prioritizing of what this group of people is actually going to do could stand to, like, you know, get some user feedback and you know, member feedback, and see like, hey, actually I signed up for this because I'm really annoyed by App Review. And right. I'm just hoping to get some help here.
Yeah, I agree. It's free trials is a really tricky one to start with, because there are sort of free trial like workarounds with in-app purchase, and I will be surprised if Apple ever does like traditional free trials. Like, I think we should hope for it and ask them for it, but I mean, that's not likely to ever happen. So it's a tricky one to start with, because you're kind of starting out with like one of the most difficult things to ask Apple to do, because I think they think they've already solved it. So, but if this had, this could very easily evolve into like, here are a couple, two or three major issues that we're advocating for this year. And I think that solves it. I don't think it's a major problem for mm-hmm. the developers union. And they say, you know, we're going to start with that, but then we're going to go to a reasonable revenue cut and other community-driven developer-friendly changes. So, like, this is the start. And I think it's a good start. Like, I think it's worth trying this. And like you said, like, probably should have started this a long time ago. The biggest challenge, I think, on some of these is, I kind of ironically, convincing developers that we need this. Like, I'm kind of bummed out sometimes when I hear developers accept that the 30% rate is how things should be. And we got a lot of feedback about this from, you know, listeners in the Core Intuition Slack too, of like, there's just a lot of people that think it's fine. And that's a real bummer, because it's not fine in my opinion. And we shouldn't accept things that are just because that's the way it is, or that's the way it was when you started development, you know,
right.
building iOS apps. Like, I just don't think we should accept those kind of things if they're not right.
I totally agree with you. I mean, it's never been part of my MO to, you know, I mean, the arguments for accepting 30% are often like, hey, stores used to take 60%.
Right.
It's like that doesn't make it okay.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a ridiculous, like, argument. If you want to go back to a real union, like workers' rights, that's like saying, well, you used to have to work 16 hours a day, so like, don't complain when you only work 12 right. hours a day. But that doesn't
exactly, yeah.
that doesn't fit.
Great example. And for that matter, some of the arguments we've seen, no disrespect to the people making these arguments, but since you bring up the, you know, the actual labor metaphor, some of the arguments have been along the lines of, hey, if you're not happy making $8 an hour, just work 12 hours a day instead of 8 hours a day, and you'll be making 50% more. You know, it's like, the specific argument I'm alluding to is, if you're not happy with a 30% cut, you should just be focusing on trying to make, to raise mm-hmm. your revenues more than 30%. It's like, I would like to do both. I would like to raise my revenues by 100%. And have Apple take 15%. Call me greedy, but I want to have all of the things be better.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the 30% is also a tricky one, like, admittedly, to start with, right? Because, like, it's unlikely Apple will change this. And we talked a couple weeks ago about Apple's huge services revenue of billions of dollars, and the App Store is at the top of that list. And so they aren't likely to just voluntarily give up billions of dollars.
Nope.
But they did change it to 15% for subscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think they'd do that, and they did it. So, you know, why not try to get 15% across the board? And it's not my problem that Apple only makes, you know, $7 billion instead of $9 billion or whatever the math mm-hmm. works out to with the App Store revenue versus iCloud storage revenue and iTunes music revenue and all these sort of things. So that's their business. They can sort it out.
Yeah. I wonder if that 15% juice for, you know, that's kind of, I wonder if that 15% offer for subscriptions was kind of rationalized as a way of juicing the subscription approach in the hopes of making overall mm-hmm. revenues higher.
Right.
Because they weren't playing with, like, I don't imagine that the vast majority of Apple's revenues are from subscription. So there's kind of like a safe area to experiment in. And that makes me wonder if there are some like new business models that Apple can continue to like experiment mm-hmm. with the pricing thing. Like they can, I think people are right when they say, no, Apple's not going to drop the 30% rate because like you just said, Manton, they'd be like voluntarily giving up. Like if they just cut it to 15%, which is, I think, a great number to go across the board, then they would be like, hey, we're giving up half of our services revenue mm-hmm. on App Store. But if they could have some kind of like, I don't know, clever way of saying, you know, I don't know what it is, to be honest, but some way of saying like, hey, for folks who meet this profile, it's going to be 15%. And, well, you know, for example, Manton, this is a completely real, I think, intellectually sound argument to put together some kind of approach where a 15% cut comes along with free trials, and maybe free trials are only allowed. I'm not saying this is great for everybody, but just theoretically, if free trials were only allowed for apps that have like a $20 or greater purchase price,
mm-hmm.
then you'd be looking at a situation where you'd be kind of like promoting the sales of higher priced and therefore higher commission to Apple mm-hmm. Products.
Right.
You might offset the difference between 30% and 15% by getting more people who are selling $2 and $3 apps to sell $20 apps.
That's really interesting. And I wish we knew kind of how things, just the breakdown of App Store revenue. I mean, that's Apple's business, but it would be really nice if we knew, for example, that like of those billions of dollars, like 90% is coming from like huge game companies or something. Mm-hmm. Because if Apple knows that, and so they know, to your point, where they can experiment without actually changing anything significantly for that quarter, mm-hmm. you know, that, so that, because they want that revenue to continue to rise. It's going to, it's growing. Like we mentioned before, it's, they make more money from services than the Mac. So they don't want to mess that up.
Right.
But maybe they can, there's some room in there to experiment. Trials going along with the 15% would be really fascinating. I don't know what that looks like, but seems like it's worth having a discussion about. But yeah, I mean, just kind of getting back to the point, like a lot of developers don't agree on the problems. And that's fine. Everybody's coming from a different perspective. But it feels like there should be enough developers who can agree on a few major issues to make something like the developers union work. And I mean, there should be thousands of people joining this. Like, I think, you know, it's only been a week, but mm-hmm. if you don't think there's too much overlap between the app and the supporter list, and I didn't put my app in, I just put my name to support the cause. So I don't know how much overlap that is, but generously it's like 1,000 people have joined this. Mm-hmm. There should be thousands of people, I think, that could agree on a couple like major issues.
Yeah. I agree. And I'm, you know, like I've jumped into this, like I said, pretty, I jumped right to my criticisms, and I just want to reiterate that I just think it's great that somebody's doing something, because I've had thoughts like this for years. I've in fact talked with other developers, longtime developers, about doing something like this. it's kind of funny. It often comes back to this idea of the union. And so it's kind of funny that like if I had started this 5-10 years ago, I might have called it a union as well. But I just think it's good. It is a good start that we've got, whether it's 500 or 1,000 or somewhere in between, people who are willing to be on this public-facing bandwagon asking for change. And some, I'll acknowledge some people out there aren't willing to put their name on something that is in the slightest bit critical of Apple.
Right.
So this is something. This is folks who either they feel like they don't have anything to lose or they're willing to lose, or they don't think that Apple is punitive. But in whatever case, these are people who defy the conventional wisdom that you shouldn't make a public statement against Apple. And I will also say, it's a public statement against Apple, but my style of public statements against Apple has been the same ever since I left Apple and I felt like I had the freedom to speak out against, quote unquote, against the company. My statements against Apple are always in support of what I think makes Apple a better company. And I think that's probably true for the vast majority of the people who are getting on board with a movement like this. It's mm-hmm. not to say, hey, Apple, you suck and you should change. It's to say, hey, Apple, we love you. We are your biggest supporters. We are the ones who make your platform in many ways what it is, and we think you can do even better.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, I've made that point a couple times over the years too, which is like we hold Apple to like a really, really high standard because they've been great. Mm-hmm. I don't hold Microsoft and Google and Amazon to the same standard. Kind of accept that like I want them to do great and they do some great work, but like I don't hold them to the same standard I do Apple. Apple has proven through the years to build really great products and to care about the right things. So we hold them to a really high standard. And when they fall short, we should complain about it or respectfully disagree on a public website. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's our responsibility as developers, as part of this community, is to speak what, how we're thinking. And like you said, not everyone can do that mm-hmm. because of where they work or they're worried about complaining. But like a lot of us can and should when we see something that could be better.
Yep. So folks, if this has appealed to you, just so you know, the Developers Union is not some kind of socialist thing. It's just call it, think of it as Developers United. And Developers Union, it's called thedeveloperSunion.org. And I think you will find it pretty interesting. Some of you folks who haven't heard of it, consider signing up. I think the gist of it now is basically sign up. You get your face, you get your app on the site, and next step, who really knows? The folks who are in charge of it, I think, will determine how to move forward. But it's kind of just about getting on the list so that you find out what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think everyone should check it out. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll talk to you next week, Daniel. I'm sure next week we will talk about WWDC because it'll be our last show before the conference. Lots going on. I'm not sure. I haven't heard much rumors. I don't know exactly what to expect, but of course, it's a big year for developers in the Apple community, the biggest year of mm-hmm. the biggest week of the year. And we'll talk about that a little more next show.
Sounds good. Talk to you then.